everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. I am Kenneth Amaduri, and we're joined today with Kevin Massengill. And his website is Mareglim.com, founder and CEO, partner of the very popular Jim Rickards. We all know Jim Rickards. You know, Kevin's got a long list of qualifications. He's an expert in the financial markets. He's contributed to many popular publications. And he was a favorite in our last interview. I mean, I got so much positive feedback from the insight that he gave us last time. We had to have him back on. So, Kevin, thanks for coming back on to Crush the Street with me today.
Well, thank you, Kenneth. I really appreciate you doing this.
Well, the last time we talked, among other things, we talked about the dollar and kind of it going into the end of its 40-year experiment, the end of the 40-year cycle that we've seen, the changes that we see with the currency. And, you know, let's start off here with the markets and the turbulence that we're seeing, especially this turbulence as we kind of approach the midterms here. I think that's why we're seeing a lot of this turbulence, to be honest with you, aside from all the other extraneous fundamentals that we know are due to eventually set into the market. But I think temporarily, I would say that we're seeing some of this fear because of the media, potentially seeing a blue wave here. But we'll get your take on that. Let's talk about the volatility in the markets, you know, what we're seeing with the dollar and your thoughts on the economy.
Wow, thanks. Well, I really appreciate you having me back on. It's a real pleasure to chat with you and your listeners. So in our opinion, what you're seeing is the end of this 40-year fiat currency experiment, right? You've never had a situation in world history where all the worlds have disassociated them, their currencies from any tangible value, right? We're playing global monopoly money now and have been since 1971. And there's never been a time in history where that's ever happened before. And so when we say we're in uncharted territory, and that's not hyperbole. You know, Jim Rickards got a chance to ask Ben Bernanke once, you know, what the hell are you doing? And Bernanke's answer was, I don't know, it's kind of an experiment.
Wow.
Okay. So, you know, they admit in, you know, when they're off camera, they have no idea what they're doing. They're just making it up as they go.
Wow.
And so all we can rely on is history, common sense, you know, some basic theological underpinnings of right and wrong, you know, some simple economic concepts like thou shalt not steal. That's a pretty good one.
Right.
So nations and societies that organize themselves with respect to honoring a core economic principle like thou shalt not steal tend to thrive, tend to do better over time, right? You see capital formation and courts emerge and increased productivity, which leads to increased living standards. It's a pretty normal flow, right? Conversely, societies that reject that start the other direction, right? You start to see degradation in living degradation in capital formation. You start to see a degradation in property rights and rule of law and corruption rising. And you get that whole cascade the other direction. In my opinion, since about the mid-1960s, America's been heading pretty much the wrong direction. And this isn't a bipartisan, this isn't a Republican-Democrat thing. This is just a generation of people alive at any given moment make decisions, and collectively they make decisions. And they can make bad ones as well as they can make good ones. And there's a reason why we're no longer on the gold standard. There's a reason why we have unfunded pension liabilities we'll never repay, right? There's a reason why we have welfare schemes that are just effectively Ponzi schemes that will never be honored. And everybody knows it. And they don't care. So as long as they get theirs, they don't care what happens to their kids and grandkids. Well, that has consequences. And you're seeing it play out before your very eyes.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And, you know, it really sets into the tone of politics. And, you know, to a certain degree, you know, Trump was a result of the frustration that a lot of the country was feeling. And we had this outsider come in, for instance, and, you know, people can criticize him on different things, you know, what he's doing with trade. I know the true libertarians will say, well, that's free trade is the best way to go. But, you know, it's political chess in so many ways that I think the president is dealing with. And it's calculated, I would say, in many instances. But before we get there, or maybe you can just expand on this. First of all, do you think Donald Trump has a chance in 2020 if we do see a major correction in the market and he's got to explain himself to a very uneducated population that what he's doing is better than what the socialist side will want to present for the country?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's two ways to think about that. And one of my great concerns, now I'm an enormous fan of the president, I'll admit, coming straight up. I would have voted for Ron Paul a third time, right, if I could have. I'm a hardcore minarchist, anarcho-capitalist, old school Murray Rothbard kind of libertarian. So Trump wasn't my first choice, right up until the debates, right up, you know, in his first Clinton, when he just turned around and said to her what no American politician would have ever said since maybe Andrew Jackson, right? And I'm like, oh, I love this dude. That guy's got more moral courage, and I have enormous respect for moral courage and intelligence, and that dude's got both. Mm-hmm. So that said, here was my first great concern, to your point exactly. As soon as Donald Trump started taking credit for the frothy stock market bubble, which was legitimate on his part, his deregulation, his tax cuts all had a nice, you know, lift effect. That's true. But what he should have said, if he really, and he and his advisors really understood the danger we were in, he should have never came off the message he was using during the campaign, which was accurate. What he should have said was, I'm really pleased to see this response. I'm pleased to see the job creation. I'm pleased to see companies repatriating. Those are all good things. But folks, don't misunderstand the danger we're in. That cracking sound you hear is the ice underneath our feet. We have $20 trillion in unfunded liabilities, right? We have $20 trillion in debt we admit we owe, right? We can never repay. You know, previous generations have destroyed our currency, and we've got a lot of pain coming to get through this. If he'd have stayed on that message, one, it'd have been accurate, and two, he'd have come out the other side of this politically much better off. By taking credit for the frothy, bubbly stock market, he's now going to take a big chunk of ownership for the crash, right? And he didn't have to do that. So, to my opinion, the only way he can help mitigate that is to stake a Judas goat out, stake a scapegoat out, and who it properly should be, of course, in my opinion, is the Fed, because, right, they're the central bank manipulators monkeying with interest rates and money and credit. They are the culprit, primarily. So, but in the last couple of months, look what he's done, right? He started to just hammer on Powell in these tweets. In my opinion, that's Trump and his people understanding we're going into really, really rocky waters, and we got to figure out how to pin this on somebody. And happily for me, they pinned it on the right target, but I wish he'd never, ever done anything other than that, right? I wish 2 years ago when he came to power, he should have said, I'm going to do everything I can to sort this. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we think that'll impact us. But man, do not lose sight of what, you know, the pain we're going to have to get through to get out the other end of this. I wish he'd never let up on that.
Yeah, I guess I understand what you're saying, and that would have hedged him. But I almost wonder if he would have, you know, set the tone that there's risk, there's problems, if we would have had the effect that we've seen in the markets, if companies would have been as optimistic.
No, that's a great point. You're right. That's the problem with this
guy. He's a leader, right? He's the captain of the ship, and he has no choice but to be optimistic, right?
No, you're probably exactly right. You probably wouldn't have seen anywhere near. It's just, you know, so here's the basic premise from Ludwig von Mises. This is a really old premise, and I'm sure Mises could quote the people he'd read before from antiquity. Once you start down this path, once you start devaluing your currency to buy political votes or by political power by stealing from prosperity out of the future, right? As soon as you start down that process, there is no way to arrest that. It only ends in either in a crack up boom of the currency that you've begun devaluing. That's it. So your only choice is now, or do we light that fire now and go ahead and get the pain over with while it's relatively less than what it'll be in the future? And the answer is nobody ever does that, ever, right? Because society, history will blame them. Nobody will give them credit for averting a future catastrophe that didn't happen, right? So nobody does that. Instead, they just punt. They just keep pushing it off as far as possible until it really is a conflagration that just takes down everybody. When he started taking credit for a great stock market, I thought, that's it. He's now going to own the correction. He's now going to own the blow up. And might that swing the country to a hard left, hard socialist? Absolutely. Look what it did to Nazi Germany, right? When they went through this exact same currency blow up at the end of, that came out of World War One, the hyperinflation of the Reichsmark. When they went through all of that, everybody knows Adolf Hitler and his party could have never gotten a toehold if it weren't for the devastation wrecked on the middle class, right? In the hyperinflations of the Weimar Republic. Everybody knows that. That's the danger. We come out the other end of this, right? It's not just that people get their pensions wiped out. It's not just that people suffer a horrible economic. It's what happens the day after when people are looking for scapegoats and they look for people to blame, whether that was the Jews in the 30s in Germany or whether that's white males today in these crazy socialist calculations. You don't know how that all plays out. And that instability, that social turbulence, can have some really dark things emerge.
So Kevin, one of the things that you mentioned in our pre-interview here, we were just chatting, is that there's a good chance the Democrats don't win until 2024, talking about the presidency. We have the Gillum race in Florida. We have Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz here in Texas. And we see these hard left candidates, these people trying to rise up in politics. I mean, socialists.
Right.
And you mentioned that it's getting too crazy, too far, in the socialist direction. And you believe it's there's a shakeup that's going to come even for the Democrats. So if you would share some thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. So for 100 years, The you've had three major movements in collectivist. So this goes all the way back to antiquity and to the fall in the Garden of Eden. You can think of it as Belin Visioni would call it Anglo-American versus Franco-Germanic. Leonard Peikoff would call it Platonic versus Aristotelian. I would call it divine versus satanic viewpoint. And it has to do with the primacy of the individual, right? And so societies that organize themselves in support of the individual as the prime core unit of society tend to thrive. And societies that organize themselves where the collective, the Borg, the race, the tribe, right, is the prime unit and the individual can be sacrificed to the goods of this abstract idea, they tend to do poorly, right? And then hundreds of millions of people get killed at the end of it in like the last century. And mankind's fortunes rise and fall based on those two ideas, which is in ascendancy, which is in decline. In the last 100 years, you've had three major global pushes towards this totalitarian Borg identity. You had the first in the Germanic efforts in Italy and Germany. Those were, they called themselves national socialists, but they were tied largely around race, right? The next one, the other one you had was an international socialist ideal, took on the name communism, but it was largely an international socialist premise, and think Russia and China, and that was generally not based on race, it was based on class, right? It was based on political class. Well, interestingly enough, there was a third push that most people have overlooked, and it was in the United States, roughly the same time frame. And their idea was to go slower. And actually, they got the idea out of socialist Great Britain, and they called themselves the Fabians. And their plan was to just do it slowly, gradually, progressively. Hence, why they, right? And their plan was to just go slower, take society along. When society pushed back, they'd back off. And when they got a little more political power, they'd advance their agenda and keep going. And they had an end game. And it was the exact same end as either Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or Maoist China. You know, they don't set out to murder 100 million people. These are quasi-religious organizations. They're trying to usher in the millennial reign without Jesus Christ. And they just happen to have to kill a bunch of people to save mankind. You know, these are sociopaths. But so in the American context, they just go slow, slow, slow. Here's what I think has happened that's different now. With the election of Barack Obama, they slipped the noose. They decided that they'd reached their end game, that they've got their secular messiah. He's going to transform America. He ran on that platform. He got elected on it. So clearly, you know, it's their time. And I think part of what you see in the their inability to accept the election of Donald Trump is a quasi-religious, cultish reaction. They are outraged in a way that you'd expect an Islamist to be outraged. It's a over-the-top, uncharacteristic, un-American reaction. It is a religious reaction. It's right. It's a reaction of a cult. And I'm not being flip or hyperbolic, or not trying to be. And the difference this time is that they don't have adult authority figures to rein them in and say, all right, well, we got as far as we could get. We got socialized medicine. That was a big push we wanted to get. Now we need to back off and bring the American people slowly, slowly, right? They went too far too fast. America wasn't ready for Miller Lite guys from a Miller Lite commercial with big mustache and beards and dresses getting in girls' restrooms, right? America's not ready for that bullshit. So they went too far too fast. And instead of backing off and going the more progressive route again, they went all in, full-blown socialist insane, screaming at the sky, pounding on the door of the Supreme Court, screaming at people in restaurants. That's not going to convert middle America, right? You're never going to convert the 30% hardcore Republicans. You're playing for the middle of the country, the independents, right? And they watch that and they're just appalled. The character assassination of a good man in Kavanaugh. I mean, just the smears, the organized smears. That's not who we are. And that's not going to gain them votes. So in my opinion, it's going to take them a series of election cycles of being just annihilated before a new generation of leadership, kind of the adults, come back into the Democratic Party, retire all the old farts that are just corrupt ideologues. They don't have any ideology. Their ideology is money and power, right? They don't believe anything. They believe whatever they think will get them elected. Those people are going to get swept away after a couple more crushing elections, the Pelosi's and the Schumer's, and all of them will be gone. There'll be a new generation. It won't be the crazy or the Gillum in Florida. It's not going to be those people. They'll be gone. They'll be swept away in these elections. There will be intelligent, reasonable adults back in charge of the Democratic Party, and they'll be back to life. But I think it's going to take crushing nationwide electoral defeats. And I my guess is they're not going to win a major national election again 2026 2028, and I just base that on they think they got a shot. Now they're going to get destroyed in these midterms, in my opinion, destroyed. Wow. Trump's going to win by a landslide. He may win with a greater electoral college victory than Reagan had against Mondale. And then, just like the nation normally, after a two-cycle presidency, it almost always goes to the alternate party down through American history. That just pattern constantly repeats. Very rarely is it broken. It was broken last by George H.W. Bush. The country was giving Ronald Reagan an honorary third term. And he only got 4 years because as soon as people realized that dude's not Reagan, he was gone, right? So I think the same thing's going to happen with Mike Pence. I think in 2024, Pence will win the presidency. again, in violation of the cycle, but because the country will be so happy with the things Trump accomplished, they're going to give Trump a third term in the form of Mike Pence, in my opinion.
Wow.
Just like Bush was given one by Reagan. Now, whether he can keep that mandate, it'll depend on him and what he can accomplish in that period. But that's what I think was very likely to happen. And if that's true, then that means they will have suffered devastating defeats in 2016, 2018, 2020, and then there's going to start being this backlash, right? But I don't think they'll be able to fully recover until after they lose another national election in President Pence's election. Then you're going to see just a wholesale Aegean stables sweeping clean, the socialist nonsense. That's what I think we're likely to be on a track for. We'll see.
Someone pointed something out to me, and it reminded me of this when you said, you know, adults coming into the party. But if you would probably know this better than I would, but in the 60s, you know, you had this massive movement, you know, with liberalism and, you know, but these are the same people who became the baby boomers who are now the conservatives. You know, this was coming of age and kind of flipping the script in certain ways. I don't know, maybe it's a whole different group of people. Maybe it's just a loud minority that we all hear about that were in the streets in the 1960s. But what are your thoughts on this? Is there going to be a coming of age of the current, you know, liberals that we see right now?
You know, it's interesting. I'm a big fan of the work by Strauss and Howe. If you've had a chance to read the Fourth Turning, I highly recommend it. And your listeners, I highly recommend it. It's not an economics book, although it has major economic impact. And it just has to do with these archetypes, these generational archetypes, like you just described. And this pattern, and it's effectively an 80-year cycle, about the length of one long-lived human. And there are four different variations. So there's 20-year blocks. And it's just the way people transition through their life, right? What you care about from 0 to 20 is different than what you care about from 20 to 40 or 40 to 60, 60 to 80, right? And down through time, there's these four generational archetypes, and they just keep repeating down through history. And this is a very old concept. The Etruscans had a name for this. The Romans had a name for this phenomenon. They call it a saculum. In Strauss and Howe, they'll go back and show you the last 80, let me get this right, the last 10 of these cycles covering the last 800 years. And you'll be like, okay, that's really interesting. From an economic standpoint, what that means is that every 20 years, there's something of a phase shift, right? As people are changing what they care about. So the people that were in their 20s, came of age in the 60s, were that boomer generation born just after the last Great War, right? And so they come of age, they rebel against their parents, the peace and prosperity of the post-war years, and they take the country kind of off a cliff, internally focused, you know, narcissistic, loud, ignorant. That archetype of a generation occurs in that 20-year period post the last great crisis all the way back past the Romans. It's just a human nature thing, right? Then when they hit their 40s, right, they settle down, they get married, realize they need to make some money, and that next 20-year period, so in an American context, 1980 to 2000, becomes the greatest growth period in that whole 80-year cycle, right? Well, now we're on the back end of that. And those same people, now in their 60s to 80s, never saw World War II. To them, it was a memory, just like the Kennedy assassination's a memory to me, or the Reagan assassination attempt was a memory to my children, right? It's just something they saw in a history book. That generation always takes the world back into the next great war, always.
Wow.
It was after 80 years of relative peace and prosperity compared to the last great crisis. They don't remember. And by now, you've built up all these debts, you've destroyed currencies, and the French logique de guerre comes to play. People just think, well, you know, at some point we're going to have to pick a fight with somebody to get out from under these debts and blame another. And here we go. And they get currency wars, then trade wars, and they almost always end in shooting wars. So from a generational cycle standpoint, all that means is the crazy millennials that you're seeing right now, what that means is behind them is going to be a much more conservative generation I think they're calling them Generation Z or something. And they're already completely the opposite of the millennial generation, just like my generation is completely the opposite of boomers. If you ask a boomer when they were growing up, what was the most important thing to them? And it was, oh, having spiritual meaning, right? I can't even say that phrase without rolling my eyes. That just sounds like jackassery. You know, my generation just rebelled against all that, that narcissistic belly button studying bullshit, right? So it's all cyclical, right? So it looks horrible right now. You're looking at these crazy millennials screaming and ranting and just showing their ass like a bunch of three-year-olds having a tantrum on the floor of Walmart, and you got to just step around them and keep going. But that's temporary. Behind them is another generation that's looking at that behavior going, oh, these people are insane. I don't have anything to do with that. you and I were talking about California, right? So today, California is our shithole, right? Just like any you know, major city that's been ran by Democrats for 40 years. Just you follow those policies, you get Venezuela. I mean, this is not rocket science. You throw hammers in the air, you're eventually going to get hit in the head. It's just policy, right? But what I was telling you, because you're a little younger, in the 70s, this was New York. People forget, right? Because now New York's this beautiful city, you know, ridiculously safe per capita compared to big cities its size. You know, it's a great place. Because the people in New York eventually got tired of a series of Democrats running their city into the ground, and they elected Rudy Giuliani, who famously turned it all around. So California can do the same. It's just up to that generation of people to decide enough's enough, right? And when they get tired of typhus outbreaks and stepping around human feces in the streets of San Francisco, they'll vote those morons out of office, and that place it'll be what you think of as New York today. It'll be beautiful again. It'll have money and tourism and business and people thriving. And it can, you know, it just depends on the decision of the people that are there, right? That generation. Yeah. That's all.
Yeah. And I love it. That's actually very optimistic. All right. So.
Oh, no. I didn't say they would. That's all. Until they do, I'm not going back.
Let's talk about, you know, the changes that we're definitely seeing. And you actually brought up war. And the only thing I would say about war is, number one, we are at war, right? We forget about that. And I'm not saying you forgot about that, but I mean, we're in Afghanistan, and it's crazy to even think about it. It's horrible that we're actually, we got this war seems to be going on that nobody cares about.
This is the first war, I think, in American history where the sons and daughters of veterans are now in Afghanistan.
We're numb.
Think of that. So we have 18-year-old soldiers that are in uniform, boots on the ground in Afghanistan, following in their father's footsteps. That is appalling, right? That is horrific. But that's not the war I'm talking about. I'm talking about a great power war that is going to be a worldwide conflagration. Doesn't have to happen. Of course, nothing ever has to happen. But the human impulses are the same. People are the same. Nothing's changed. We have better dentistry. We have cool cell phones. We are exactly the same people as we were 100 years ago, as we were 1,000 or 10,000 years ago. Nothing's changed. And so the cycle has been, at this point of the cycle, you wipe out the debt, you wipe out the currency destruction, you kind of restabilize everything. And part of that process tends to be a massive war. Not because it's good, not because it's helpful, it's not, but because the people in charge of the world didn't see the last one. They weren't there. They were born afterwards. And these massive wars end for the same reason. They end for moral exhaustion. They end because people are just tired of the death and destruction. They're morally exhausted. Not because they can't continue, but because they don't want to. And then that's gone as that generation dies out. And here we go again. This is an old, old story.
Yes. Okay, so let's move on here with talking about.
Sorry for that dark.
No, it's true. It's crazy to even think about that we're still in this war. You know that are you know, we could have fought in, or you know, dads fought in, and then the children right. are fighting in. We're numb. We don't even see it. It's not even news anymore. And that's I think half of it is we don't even talk about it.
Right.
But you know, that's we'll see where this ultimately ends up. But I'd like to get and talk about AI. And this is something that I know you guys do. You use predictive analysis for the benefit of investment decisions, giving you a good indication of where things are going and how to invest in something, which I think is an absolute disruptor. And we've been talking heavily about artificial intelligence here at Crush the Street. But before we talk about the company, talk to us about AI. How big of a disruptor do you believe AI to be going forward here in the 21st century? And, you know, what does that mean for jobs and society as we know it?
So that's another great question. So I take the libertarian view of technology. I don't view it as a bad thing. Of course, it's disruptive, but the internal combustion engine was disruptive, right? Think about how many buggy whip manufacturers and wheelwrights were put out of business, right? I mean, it happened quickly. I think I read the other day from in 1900, New York City was full of horses. There was like one car in a picture this guy put up. And 13 years later, it was all cars. 13 years and one horse on the street. And I mean, think about that. And this was when there wasn't an automotive manufacturing base or a liquid fuels, petroleum fuels base. These all had to be created from scratch. And 13 years later, there we were. So these things happen really quickly. Now, does that mean a whole bunch of people got put out of jobs? Sure. Did that mean there was mass employment, unemployment, and starvation? No, it just meant that new jobs were created, jobs that people couldn't even conceive of, right? And so, I mean, here's a simple thought experiment. To a civilization that is pre-18-wheel truck, think about the lines of people that are carrying goods in baskets on their heads from place to place. Think about their reaction the first time they see a Peterbilt 18-wheel truck come over the horizon, right? What's their reaction? Oh my God, I'm out of a job, right? You know how many jobs that's going to take away, right? That's their first reaction. It's a legitimate concern for the person who's carrying stuff on his head. I don't mean to be flip about that. They're going to have some economic pain in the transition. But for society as a whole, is it a benefit? Absolutely.
It's efficiency.
Quality of life matters. Living standards matter. You know, lower infant mortality rates and better dentistry matter. And those are all good things too. And they're just not as measurable or as immediately obvious. So yes, people are right to be concerned about the short-term impact. It got to be, but you ought to take a little bit longer view as well and recognize that, for example, you know, we all know Ned Ludd, the Luddites are named after him, this famously anti, you know, the name is now has come to mean anti-technology, right? Well, Ned Ludd was a highly skilled worker who wielded steel shears, think scissors, 75-pound scissors, right? And these men were very well trained and very well paid, and they were an essential component in woolen manufacturing, right? Well, when the weaving looms were invented, their jobs were made superfluous. And it had these were very well paid workers, right? This was going to major as it was. And they began burning factories and killing factory owners that dared to put in the new looms. But just a couple of years later, once the new looms were up, it so greatly reduced the price of woolens, right, that now everybody could afford them. And so there was a great deal more being manufactured. There was way more people now employed in the woolen manufacturing business because, you know, the supply-demand curve changed and now so many more people could afford these goods, right? Now, was it tough on those skilled laborers that had to make the transition? Absolutely. And I don't denigrate what they went through. I disavow the violence they employed. But you just need to recognize that for every dislocation like that, there is a concomitant benefit out the other end. And it's easy to focus, you know, this is what Henry Hazlitt made his point in Economics One Lesson, that the failure of good economics is to not ask about impacts on everyone and down through time, but to just focus on the short term and what's immediate, what's seen, right? You know, I think it was Bastiat's, what is seen and unseen, right? And so that's what I'd ask your listeners to keep in mind, right? That it can sound scary, and it is scary to the people that are disrupted, but the end is often a much better living standard for everybody and much more employment for everybody.
Sure.
So that's my first caveat.
Right. You have the truck driver or the driver in the U.S., the number one occupation. And we already know driverless cars are coming. So this is going to be a huge disruptor for them.
That will be a massive disruption. Absolutely.
And then going back to the horse and buggy, and then you have the cars, right? You have, travel now exploding, motels popping up all over the place. And then all of a sudden now you have a drive-through and you have fast food. And of course that helps the medical industry, right? So, I mean, there's so many.
A feeder system to bad health, right?
So absolutely. No, we've definitely talked about, and we've been careful to use the word disruptor.
Yeah, no, I think that's the right way to approach it.
And not a destroyer of jobs, because I do believe there's going to be a lot of opportunities that come about because things become more efficient. And I'd like to talk about, you know, how you guys are using predictive analysis. I know Ray Dalio talks about how they use algorithms and certain things to assist in the returns that they've seen at Bridgewater. Right. And it's, you know, worked wonders for them. So I'm curious as to, you know, how you guys are employing this and how it pertains to what you're doing going forward.
So I'm no expert on Ray Dalio, although I've read his book and I'm a big fan. What I can tell you that we do differently than I think anybody else. And if somebody else is doing it, we haven't found them yet. And we've looked diligently. We take a combination of human intelligence and machine intelligence, because we think that combination is what is most powerful. You can take a supercomputer in chess. It will be routinely defeated by three average non-ranked chess players backed up by two average machines. The combination of those five entities will beat that supercomputer every time. It's just that it's the combination of machine and human that is so powerful. So what we've done is we've stepped back, looked at how AI was applied initially, and decided that the mistake was that people were asking it to do more than it could do, right? But what it can do, it can do better than anybody on the earth. So for example, we start with the expert narrative. We start with the assumption that we can't ask machines to tell the difference between sense and nonsense. That takes human judgment, right? And so we start from the premise that capital markets are complex adaptive systems. They are much more like a hurricane weather pattern or an ecosystem at Yosemite than they are a giant industrial machine, right? You and I may have talked about this before. And this is the great mistake we think central banks, governments, the economics profession, they're fixated in a worldview of economics that they adopted about 100 years ago, a little more, when they saw physics getting all the attention, all the glory, all the grants, all the girls, and they wanted to be more like them. And so that, you know, economics has radically shifted from its roots in actually, economics is a branch of moral philosophy. Most people would think it's a branch of the math department, right? And that's because 100 years ago, they went all in physics and they decided they'd make themselves more relevant by creating these formulas, these elegant math formulas, and pretending that that had some linkage to the real world. Right? It doesn't. But it's convenient to governments. It gives justification for what they're doing. You can think of Keynes as a court jester, a court paid philosopher that supported, you know, government's interaction. So they embraced him. But it's all false. An economy is no more amenable to manipulation by external players than a hurricane is, right? I mean, imagine if you listen to a weather forecaster saying, so here's what we've got in this weather pattern. We're going to go out and we're going to manipulate the barometric pressure. We're going to change the temperature at the surface level of the ocean. And we're going to move that hurricane this direction. Right? Everybody that heard that would just go, what? They're an idiot, right? Or somebody that works on Yosemite talking about how they're going to fix Yosemite. They're going to dial up the number of badgers. They're going to dial back the number of bears. They're going to make it more efficient, right? You just, what? That is a complex adaptive system. You can't make changes without having a cascade of unintended effects, right? So that's the real world, and that's how real capital markets function. And government, central banks, finance professions, they don't understand that. They are functioning effectively like alchemists. and I'm not being hyperbolic. Alchemy was for centuries the premier science of its day. Thousands and millions of dollars in capital spent, brilliant people spent their lives studying a deep body of knowledge that we now today know is just completely false, right? It was all nonsense. But they didn't know that. And they spent their lives trying to convert nothing into something of value, looking for the shortcut to wealth. Well, think about the economics profession. Think about governments. Think about central bankers. What are they doing today, right? They're not telling you produce, save the surplus between what you spend, build a capital savings, invest that with prudence, and help grow the economy. That's not what they're telling people to do. No, they tell people go out and spend, right? We'll kite checks with monopoly money. People will have a wealth effect, right? We'll trick them into thinking that economic times are good and they'll start spending money and that'll make it so, right? It's animal spirits. Really? Really? Is there any other field of human study that you people would talk like that and you'd take them seriously? That's just asinine. It's alchemy, right? That's not how the real world works. Economies grow based on you producing more than you eat. That's it. Save the surplus. It's got a good idea and grow the capital formation. That's the real life, right? You can't get rich by going into debt. You can't get rich by kiting checks, not as an individual, nor as a society. Okay. Sorry about the rant. So we start with subject matter experts who understand that's how the real world works, right? You take their intellect, you take their brain, you take their ideas of how conceptual components are linked, you map that into a three-dimensional model we call a cognitive map. Now you've got something that's actually closer to how reality actually functions, but it's so complex that no analyst or team of analysts I could hire could keep it updated. Now, this is what artificial intelligence was built to do, right? This is what a natural language processor can do. It can't build that cognitive map for me. It can't tell me if Janet Yellen or Ben Bernanke or Powell understands how the world works better than Jim Grant or Pippa Malmgren or Jim Rickards. It can't tell sense from nonsense. But what it can do is look at a model that we've built and monitor 9 million books, articles, transcripts a day, which processing, and update each of those nodes, edges, and update them with current information. It can do that. And it can do that, and a team of humans never could, right? That's what we've done that's different. We start with human subject matter expertise. We instrument that narrative. Then we apply artificial intelligence to do, can do, right? And now what comes out the other end of that for our clients is this shockingly elegant solution. Here's an example. People say, they scoff, you can't predict the future. Nobody can. And if you say you can, you're just a charlatan or a fool, right? Nassim Taleb's view of the world, and he's spot on accurate. Here's the way I'd answer that. 200 years ago, if I had told, I live in North Florida, so we just had this happen. If 200 years ago, I told you there's a storm offshore, you can't see it. You can't tell it's coming, right? But in 48 hours, it's going to come ashore within 30 miles of this point. It's going to land within 15 minutes, plus or minus this time. It's going to be traveling at roughly this speed in roughly this direction from here toward Tallahassee. And that'll happen 48 hours from now, right? If I did that 200 years ago and it happened, just like Michael landed, within 15 minutes of landfall predict two days before, you'd be dunking me in water to see if I floated. That'd be witchcraft, right? That's crazy. How did you do that? You can't do that. And so are the weather forecasters predicting the future? No, of course not. What they're doing is applying the right math to the problem. They're applying complexity science, a 60-year-old math, to the right problem, to a problem of complexity, a problem of complex adaptive systems, which a weather system is, right? And they're taking all the myriad variables, surface temperature, air temperature, temperatures at this height, wind speeds at different places, barometric pressure. They're taking all of this data and they're putting it into this complexity science algorithms that they've developed now over years. And they're doing things that 100 years ago, but maybe 15 years ago, would have seemed magical, right? Are they predicting the future? Of course not, right? They're applying the right science to the right problem. That's all we're doing. So when we look at complex adaptive systems that make up financial markets, and we input the 30, 40, 50, 60 different variables and how they all interact with each other, and then we weight that, and then we update those variables in real time and run our complexity science algorithms over the top of that, what you're getting is almost, I almost say identical, because actually we've had some breakthroughs ourselves that are proprietary, that it can be understood just like your national weather stations are doing to calculate. It's not predictive, you know, woo woo, you know, listen to us because we're really smart and we can predict the future. No. Play God, we've just taken the right math and science, applied it to the right problem in a way that people haven't recognized yet, because they just don't recognize that capital markets are complex adaptive systems, just like an ecosystem, just like a forest fire, just like a hurricane. Sorry about that, if that was long-winded way to get to answer your question.
No, honestly, I wish we had more time. You're the type of person, you to me, you know, I like listening to Rick Rule talk and just how he explains things and makes me think about things in a brand new way. And this is exactly what I'm doing when I'm sitting here, just absorbing this information.
Well, that's high praise. I'm a huge fan of Rick Rule.
A few things regarding AI and just the cycles of history today. And I know the audience is going to greatly appreciate it. So
well, thank you, Kenneth. I take that as high praise indeed. I'm a huge fan of Rick Rule. So I take that as a great compliment.
Awesome. Awesome. We love Rick Rule here. Kevin, if you would share some closing thoughts and let people know what they can find if they reach out to you, you know, or want to get more information from your website and what you do.
So Jim and I have built this world's first predictive data analytics engine, primarily focused on institutional investors right now. At some point in the future, we may figure out how to take that to retail. But if you're interested in reading, we publish an enormous body of work. Go to meraglim.com, M-E-R-A-G-L-I-M. The name you may not recognize, but the story you would. We named the company after the 12-man reconnaissance team that Moses sends into the promised land. He has to pull the 12 crown princes of the 12 tribes, and he makes a reconnaissance unit to go into the promised land. 10 famously come back panicked. 2, Joshua and Caleb famously see all the opportunities. And Jim and I thought this was just a great analogy for what we're doing. And in Hebrew, the proper name of that team is called the Meraglim, or Meraglim anglicized. We like that a lot. Go to the website, check out the blog. If you're interested in the backstory, more of what we do, go to the bibliography. There's some fantastic reading there if you're interested to know more. And you can follow a lot of our work there, and you'd be most welcome.
Well, thank you, sir, for coming on Crush the Street with me today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ken.